known the how many inputs and inputs this result? How many inputs the system taking?
At a systems level, it's not known, and as a at a mechanistic level, it's not known. So so experimentally, we battle against this lack of knowledge by making sure the yeast are in exactly the same growth conditions and other circumstances. That which we cannot, enumerate, we try to control for. So in some sense, the cell is sensing all kinds of things to make this decision to arrest or not, and we don't want to go there because we don't have any good way. But this is not a wire. Parenthetically, the MADS proteins and the nuclear receptors, they're this kind of single step to nucleus signal transduction systems that biology has used, at least in those two prototypic classes. So, there's places where that does happen. This is, however, Doran, if he's here, the canonical G. This is a MAP kinase cascade. This is prototypic for an awful lot of cellular responses to extracellular signals in higher eukaryotes. This is probably the single most commonly used setup that you're looking at in its prototype here. So perhaps there's certainly evolutionary reason why that's used, i.e., it worked once, but maybe there's some mechanistic.
Different systems, are the same component using different system or the different proteins using different
system? Well, let's see, broadly speaking, what I'm saying is, if you look at G protein coupled receptors and you count the smell receptors, then instead of yeast having one of these for mating pheromone, we have 2,000 out of our 100, out of our 40,000 proteins.
Okay. And it's the same protein that's being
used? And in this case, you might have heard this, where vertebrates almost certainly went through a quadruplication of genes from yeast. So where yeast, worms, and flies have one of everything, vertebrates tend to have four of them, sometimes three and sometimes five and so on. So picture each one of these with three or four different things, and they're not wholly redundant. Some are used in some tissues and some aren't. Okay, so so we wish to, account for the qualitative behavior. We wish to turn this into numbers. And so, enter Coleman Lerner, Alejandro. And so, these are actually artificial promoters. But this is a stylized representation of a budding yeast, with this being the bud. And essentially, Alejandro has last year a yeast that turns yellow if it's gonna sense that whiff of mating pheromone in the air, and cyan if it's gonna decide to ignore the pheromones and the anxieties and conflicting emotions produced and just serenely sail on. So there is a concentration of the mating pheromone in the medium at which half the cells turn yellow within half an hour. Now,
what's going on with cyan?
Oh, so we have two different promoters. Gene regulatory region. So what we have is so what's turning on yellow is a promoter which it's a derivative, but originally it came from a gene that was involved with mating. What's turning on cyan is a derivative of a promoter that that is involved in making histones, which you need for DNA replication. So you're gonna if you're gonna go ahead and enter S phase where you replicate DNA, you're gonna start making histones. Okay, so that's the basis. And then these are actually, they're both fake at this point. So, Alejandro abstracted the elements that convey that regulation. So then there's this number. Okay, so now the first thing you learn is that there are yeast that are, confused adolescents. They get the signal and they both decide to be yellow and cyan. They just don't know what's going on. Okay, there may or may not be. I can't give you any numbers on the prevalence of that. There may or may not be. I can't swear to this now. There may be bad managers or vacillators who go like yellow, cyan. Okay. So correct. So just looking under the microscope, so immediately, you know, you start thinking in these terms, you're learning about system behavior in the effort to wrestle system behavior down to a quantifiable thing already is paying some dividends qualitatively. Okay, now, and then of course what happens is that the, so then this information goes together with information the best we can from literature and our own experiments about the quantity of the different molecular species involved in the quantities of the different molecular species involved in the process and the probable rate constants. Oh, this is experimental data. So this is, just pay attention to alpha factor here. So here's a clump of yeast that have been here's different clumps of yeast that have been exposed to threshold concentrations of alpha factor, and here's cyan. These guys are not gonna arrest, and then these other guys are yellow. They're gonna arrest, and there's some that are neither fish nor fowl at this concentration. So this is that's a sort of data. Okay, now. Here we go into the model, and now we have many iterations of this model, and this model is never going to be finished. It's, you know, it's kind of like a cathedral or something like that. You know, people are going to work on it, and then they're going to go away for 25 years, and you know, from the field, or hopefully not that long, but they're going to, you know, there's bursts of model building that are punctuated with people wandering off and doing other things and then coming back and working some more on the model when enough data seems to justify it. This is what you're looking at is a previous version of the model. So this incorporates everything we know about the pathway up to this gene transcription, making some fairly okay assumptions in here about mechanism. All this stuff up here, most of the mechanism we're sure of. We've made our best guesses as to and measurements in some cases on quantities of things, and our best guesses in almost all cases it's guesswork on the rates. What you're looking at on that graph is the numbers of molecules of various protein species. Not yet. No, this is the number of molecules of various kinds of proteins. So let's just go through this. Here we are at minus 200 seconds. Yeast is minding its own business, and it has what looks like 6,500, 7,000 molecules of unbound alpha factor receptor, the GPCR, on its surface, and so on. This is numbers of molecules of alpha factor in the medium, and at 0 seconds, this poor A guy gets the shock of his life as the medium is flooded with alpha factor, and he's forced to respond in various ways. So green line here is the number of molecules of unbound alpha factor receptor, the so-called sterol 2 gene product, in this case, Doran. So you see that's decreasing. You know, there's less and less unbound receptor. And then you see the numbers of various molecular species. Well, there's only one transcript, which is...
You can call different lines by names such as bound and unbound.
Yes. Okay, if you will. Yeah, sure.
Not only just the protein, as many of the transcriptionists do, but what the protein does. What was phosphorylated and so on.
Sure, exactly. Exactly. In that sense, see, in fact, in that sense, what we've done is we've taken the concept of activity and function and we've just ducked around it. Instead of explicitly dealing with that, we're explicitly dealing with individual named molecular species, and embedded within each molecular species. If this protein is phosphorylated, it becomes active. So we don't know that it becomes active. We just track its being phosphorylated. So, yes, so this is a simulation of a single cell. I don't know. This is rate of diffusion of alpha. This is based on data from Jeremy Thorner and deeper inside that. I'll remember his name in a second. Works at University of Massachusetts Medical School, Worcester. Most of this is based on experimental data. It has not been fit.
So the time series information you get from the RNA chips is not expressed here?
No, and in fact, there's no RNA chip experiment which has looked at that. The only new gene transcription event whose consequence we are monitoring here is this one, which is transcription of the reporter gene, which is eventually making the yellow color.
That's the only thing you look at.
Right. Now, over longer time scales, there are changes in gene transcription which manifest themselves in changes in the amount of these protein products. But
that's not part of the
network. That's right. What we're concerned with, yeah, that's a good point to make. Look, the particularly in this realm of things that happen within seconds or milliseconds, the information processing is done by these protein-mediated events. There's not time to transcribe a new gene product and make enough of it to have it make a difference.
Time series protein?
We don't have it. So we don't. The only protein whose new synthesis we're tracking is this, which is the fluorescent reporter molecule. Everything else?
Protein in various states.
Yes. Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Do you have time series for some of
those? Do we have experimental data for some of those? In very few cases. Okay, so, but at least the experimental methodology there is relatively simple. We can get to that on a population level.
How do you get the ray clusters, the hundreds of them that are needed for
the We make them up based on our best understanding of the rate constants of similar protein kinases and whatnot. So, diffusion, but within a well-mixed compartment. Okay.
What are your experimental hopes to be able to take a numerical experiment like this and compare this with the time series you get out of experiments?
Precisely. Yeah. Okay. So now we can. When we look at when yellow color is expected, it was first, so we can run this simulation 100 times and we get 100 different answers because it is stochastic. Did you have a question before we?
This is a delay.
It is, yes.
Why didn't you just compare it to the standard?
Well, then we'd only get one answer when we ran it 100 times. Oh, it's qualitatively similar to the mean of the. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, how well do I know that? I'm not totally sure how well I know it, but that's.
For example, binding and unbinding of promoter sites are even 0 or 1, and treating that as a differential equation would seem likely to cause problems.
Well, I think by the time we're out here, you know, we got 100 molecules of yellow fluorescent protein, and we're adding one or we're not. And it's only out here where we can begin to pick up the signal. I'm sorry, at about 800 molecules or so of the fluorescent protein, we think we can pick up the signal. Let's see. Hang on. Let's get rid of this one. The two guys who go fast. Well, let's see what. That's okay. This is the third line from the top. That's the A means alpha factor because they used Roman type. 2 is sterol 2, the receptor, and then that's bound to the trimeric G protein, sterol 4, sterol 10, and GPA1. I'm sorry, sterol 4, sterol 18, and GPA1. So that's the concentration of the receptor bound to the trimeric G protein. So that soars. Excuse me. See, here's the receptor, and then let's see. I think on this graph, I think all we're showing is the concentration of the unliganded receptor. Oh, I see. This is, it looks like green line here is receptor plus the trimeric G protein, so it's already parked there. So that's why it soars. And so now, The concentration of unliganded receptor is just 1 minus this number, I guess, is the answer. I mean, you know, so this is the thing, this is the amount that's unliganded.
The total protein concentration is constant.
And the total protein concentration.
One of the two
right.
States.
Right.
And no other quantum
together. Right. Okay. So, let's see. Okay, so questions have pointed up the precocity of this exercise. Now, what happens is we then can and did fit in a couple of cases this simulation output to match what we observed from single cell measurements. Okay, cool. Now we go back and we perturb the system genetically. We take sterol 5, one of these players, and we in the vernacular, we knock. Our favorite manipulations are those where they're made in the DNA, so we know exactly what we did, and then we just look at the difference in equilibrium behavior. So we change tata in the promoter region to taga, and then we measure how much we've knocked down sterol 5 expression. If memory serves, it's a factor of 18. So now we can say.
So you measured it. You measured it
in vitro? Well, yeah, by breaking open cells and looking at the amount of protein present in the cells on which we perform this manipulation.
Okay.
So, you know, at least we can always go back to. These are the population level measurements I'm telling you that I'm not so high on. Okay. But. So anyway, so we go back, and so we run this through the model, and it predicts a system output based on this lower concentration of sterol 5. And in fact, of course, that doesn't match the experimental behavior. And so we're in this. I'm blaming. Yes. Then we do an experiment. Yeah, we do an experiment, and it doesn't match the simulation. You know, surprise, surprise. So so now we think about what we need to change in the simulation. And so we have a cycle, you know, which we can get going between this and this. But the problem is that that what we're measuring is, you know, an event which is the consequence of numerous upstream events. You know, so this points up the inadequacy of this particular, you know, single cell way in. So what, okay, now just to give the physical basis for the protein-protein interaction, which, by the way, we have not gotten working in single cells, but somebody did last week in Science, and so we're eagerly attempting to copy this. What we have gotten done is reproduce this. An experiment. Oh, well, can you see this? This.
You can bring this down.
Ah, okay. Okay, so so again, Roger Chen. So yellow and cyan are a real good pair for fluorescence resonance energy transfer. And Chen and co-workers demonstrated, in fact, that irradiating yellow with some higher wavelength light, I don't remember the excitation frequency now, you get out cyan and you get less yellow fluorescence than you expect when and only when you're making a bimodular protein of the structure done here. And we've reproduced that. So we can see fret between yellow and cyan. And just this week in Science, Giannopoulos et al., and I have the paper here, got fluorescence resonance energy transfer measurements of G protein trimerization or not going in Dictys coelom. So
this is a way of using this fluorescence to tell whether what the fraction of bound pair you
right.
get.
Right. Right, okay. So we're also working on this is now work by a guy named Richard Yu in the lab. What? So this thing was a single polypeptide chain that Roger Chen made some 3 years ago as a proof of concept, which we've also done recently. So in this is it just has two blobs, one of which is yellow fluorescent protein, another one which is cyan.
Science article had the YFP and the CFP on different
right,
proteins.
different portions of a trimeric G protein in dictyostelium. Oh, I'm sorry.
Different protein.
Different protein. This particular protein involved in the signal transduction thing is a trimer, and its trimerization is ever so important to biologists.
Trimer means
three-mer.
Copies swooshing together.
Yeah, there were three individual proteins, and two out of three of those.
Maybe the structure and the processes of what is known as the quaternary
structure. Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. So sometimes we refer to these as monomers and sometimes moieties. This Institute of Theoretical Physics is really playing games with access to the Apple Talk Network, but I don't know what to do about this, but we'll carry on. All right, so similarly, Richard Yu is working on molecules of yellow fluorescent protein and cyan fluorescent protein. I'm still not going to talk about kind of the workhorse recognition methods that we do. I could, but I think it's better for me to focus on this experimental program now. Basically, okay, so Richard is making derivatives of various FPs that have on them a so-called peptide aptamer, which is a recognition molecule that we know how to make, we know how to select, that can target individual molecular species, including phosphorylated forms of individual proteins. So Richard Yu is working on general methods to measure the numbers of phosphorylated protein species inside individual cells. Now, the problem with this last measurement is that this guy binds the phosphorylated species, and so it contributes energy. So it's going to increase the amount of the phosphorylated species. This is an example, this is a classical example of a means of measurement perturbing the measurement. And so we're going to have to factor this in. So, well, in other words, so this guy is to bind the phosphorylated form. So if it binds phosphorylated form, there's free energy here. Okay? So it's going to shift the equilibrium. Okay. Another way of putting it, the way a biologist might put it, it's going to bind the phosphorylated form. So the phosphatase that would normally take that phosphate off won't be able to get in. I think those two statements are probably interchangeable. Okay. Well, then this recognition guy is going to bind to a phosphate group here. And when it does, the fluorescence properties of this thing will change because this is coupled in a way that I don't want to describe now, too.
The steric hindrance version changes the dynamics and the energetics. And in equilibrium, the energetic piece is the only thing that changes the equilibrium concentration. But the steric parts can change the time to reach equilibrium.
Okay. Okay.
Right. So they are both the same thing, but the steric part incorporates also the implications about the dynamics.
Okay. Okay. So
when you had these two models, you had a model, made a change, the model no longer worked, there's an improved model, and they start talking about this.
What I'm saying is, until the cows come home, there's so many different things we can change plausibly in response to any individual measurement of system output, that in order to not have this a sterile exercise, we need, I believe, this downstream event that we measure is the consequence of numerous upstream events. We need to quantitate these upstream events. We need to get a better handle on the amount of G protein. This is the trimer here, GPA1, sterol 4, sterol 18.
Now,
that is.
When you turn on and off this particular thing, the only thing you measured was whether it,
correct.
Whether it turned blue or.
Correct. And that was a triumph. What I'm saying that's already a triumph to get it, or at least a reasonable achievement on Alejandro's part to get it to this.
And we've been working on methods of incorporating several different kinds of experiments, and then doing some kind of fitting procedure,
mm-hmm.
which would take a given model and see if it's compatible with all the different experiments simultaneously.
Great.
But if the only thing you know about the experiment is what fraction turned green, it's not going to,
Well, right, we need, I mean, I'm just saying that this is a very typical biologist thing we've done. We've even driven it upstream a little bit into this process. But what we need is ways into the workings here.
Right, to be able to measure everything, then the modeling isn't quite as challenging.
You know, we won't be able to measure anything. Dr. Hill. Define form.
Do you have a sentence, or do you use the first order type reaction?
Well, this is standard reaction kinetics. When the reaction is first order, it's first order, and so on. It's done with this a la Gillespie, so everything's done stochastically. So a first order reaction, you know, any differential equation that fits into the reaction kinetics has its parallel in Gillespie's code.
We were just wondering, these arrows, each of those arrows, some of them are phosphorylation reactions, some of them are...
Good.
And each of those reactions needs an equation in the computer.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And that equation has a form, and that form hasn't been measured for each of those arrows. Presumably, you assume that this arrow, because it's a phosphorylation reaction, is like other phosphorylation reactions that will have this general form.
What do you mean form, if I may?
Something called functional shape, like if it's a quadratic or linear.
Oh, yeah, I see.
If it saturates, you increase the
hyperbolic
amount of, which I guess is called the Hale's method.
Yes, exactly,
Hyperbolic.
Yeah, exactly, and so when things are one guy bumps into another guy, you know, then they're...
is the following. You can assume a functional form and only fit parameters, and you can go more wild and let the computer decide which functional form
of
these reactions takes.
No, but we're telling it that. And, you know, I mean, we know, you know, molecule A phosphorylates molecule B. Okay, we know when A and B have to come together to do something to C. You know, I mean, we're putting this in, you know, we're putting into this all our knowledge, which by the standards of the biologist tribe is considerable of mechanism.
Absolutely. This is a particularly well understood system, and the fact that you still, the implementation of a mathematical model is still challenging even for things that are well understood.
Right, that a biologist would say this is well understood, and it's just not.
How much guesswork is there in fixing these various...
There's a great deal, particularly when it goes to the rates. Well, I mean, not guesswork,
but... Well, how many constraints do you have? Do you have a 10 constraint, 50 constraint, 99 constraint?
What's constraint mean? Experimental modification? Well, for the weights, everything we're making up, basically, with very few exceptions, okay? For the species concentrations, we know the concentrations of the monomer species in most cases rather well. For no.
Okay. So
as a function of steady state before and to some extent after.
Good. Okay.
I'm going to get back to why we really don't know the concentrations of species when you think about it more carefully. I'm going to get to this. This is a tremendous, I can't overestimate over-exaggerate the need for, you know, new kinds of experimental methods to get this sort of data. And you covered that in your JSON report. Okay, so that's at the single cell level, which is where we want to be whenever possible, because genetically identical individuals differ from one another. We also want to learn how to measure in populations those things that we can't measure in single cells. I'll give two examples. One is so we're learning how to make affinity reagents which react against every single protein product in this pathway, and we're trying to make affinity reagents which interact with specifically with individual phosphorylated forms and individual dimeric surfaces formed by interaction between two proteins, and we're learning how to extract rates by looking at the species and populations in real time. Let me do that one first. Yeah, because of all these fluctuations. And in fact, the cells, I should have said this, you know, when we do the simplest alpha factor measurement, you know, when you know how long does it take 100 cells in a population to turn yellow, starting from a dose of alpha factor that would mesmerize the average teenager, the answer is, you know, it takes them different amounts of time to turn on. Bing, bing, bing. You know, there's considerable cell-to-cell variation, just as you would expect. The idea that there were, in some cases, 5 molecules of this key species, 3 molecules of this. Okay, now, how to track on a population level, how to get a handle on rates. This is something I've been pushing pretty hard on. What the green guy is a protein kinase. That's the guy who puts phosphates onto things. The stop sign shaped guy is the substrate of the protein kinase. And look, so that's the protein kinase acting on the substrate to phosphorylate it. When it does, the substrate weighs more. Enter protein mass spectrometry. So as many of you know, protein mass spectrometry went from a kind of toy thing in the middle 1980s to being able to be done intelligently in the 1990s, and is just now kind of poised to realize its promise. You know, digress a little bit. The breakthrough was ways to ionize proteins gently. There's 2 main ways that's done. One is to mix the protein molecules together with an ablative substance that absorbs laser light. So mysteriously, for whatever reasons, when that absorbs laser light, the protein is blasted into space and is singly ionized. That's called MALDI, or when it's done on a surface, CELDI. That's an acronym, never mind. Another is electrospray, where the protein is in a small droplet, which is then ionized. And then as the droplet evaporates, the charge is transferred to the protein. Now, the mass resolution in some of these techniques is astonishing, as is the sensitivity. The king in both the king that combines both of those is what's called Fourier transform ion cyclotron resonance, protein mass spectroscopy. So that's as you might imagine. So they're running around in a cyclotron, and as they keep coming past the point, you can run the measurement as long as you want to get it more sensitive. So here you have 10 mass resolution of 1 part in a million or less, or more result, and you have sub-attomolar sensitivity on toward zeptomoles. An attomole is 10 to the minus 18th moles. A zeptomole would be 10 to the minus 21st. So an attomole is like 6 times 10 to the 5th of something. So now we're talking extraordinary stuff. So the idea here is simple. And
this is still cell
population. This is going to be in a population, yeah. So, but in other words, if I have 1,000 molecules of this stuff in a cell, and I can see 600,000 things, then I'm saying I only need 600 cells worth. Right, so I'm getting there, you know. And the mass spec people are kind of descendants of analytical chemists, and they are just driven to achieve greater and greater sensitivity.
So the rough picture is, you were saying before, the current tools, you actually, for each found species, you have to do a lot of work to figure out exactly how to measure how much phosphorylated version of this protein there is, right?
Worse, for each bound species here, we're going to have to develop entirely new experimental methods. You know, for the first one, which will then hopefully be prototypic.
This method, you can,
it might be a general. Right.
By weight.
Right.
All the different bound.
Well, all the different, you know, in this case, if we bust everything up into monomers, look at the difference in mass. This is some 60-odd Daltons.
Right.
So they come off
of this ablative process.
These are ionized by electrospray, and there's a problem that the cutoff, but
they don't bust up during the.
We don't bust them up during, and we like to get the mass spec guys to think that they're going to work with these things native. They like to bust them up into small peptides. So, but anyway, you see just to get the idea out here. So the idea is really simple. You have some kind of yeast cell sap. And you learn to identify the individual protein components because they're different distinguishable mass peaks. And as their mass changes because of modification events, you determine the new modified species, and you can look at then dynamically. You can give the teenagers a blast of pheromone, and you can watch the movement of mass from this species into this massier species. So that's if we can, so this involves working with the state-of-the-art mass spectrometers who are...
Mass spectrometers can look at all the different weights all at once?
Well, the thing is, they can look at... No, they can look at that, as opposed to the earlier way of detecting, they can look at, say, 1,000 different things at once. So ideologically, they are analytical chemists. They like things to be clean. They like things to be extremely well-defined. They don't like dealing with sap. You know, sap and goo are, you know, the soil from which biology springs. You know, and so it's kind of anti-chemical. To get back to that, enter Orna Reznikov. Okay, so, you know, Orna's remit is to figure out, among other things, like herding these mass spectrometer people who have other things that they think are interesting. One of her overall goals is to figure out how to fractionate sap into about 10 different fractions, each one of which only contains several hundred of these species. So then the mass spec people are on comfortable enough ground, although it's new ground for them.
Is it pretty clear when you put all your yeast cells in the blender and then separate them into 10 species and things like that, that these binding and unbinding reactions are proceeding during the process?
Well, you know, what you do, I mean, here's Reznikov. Okay, so blue pipette tip. So now she's, you know, like say she's trying to do a dynamical. Well, first, okay. Before I get there, now our first order experiment is to look at which species are phosphorylated and so on when we've gotten rid of this protein kinase. So, you know, our first order experiment is simply to do those huge and long-lasting equilibrium perturbations of which geneticists are fond. But I did describe the dream, which is to do the dynamical thing with the rates. So now the notional experiment is, here's Reznikov, okay, and so she adds the mating pheromone, and then at 30 seconds she takes a milliliter and she blasts that into liquid nitrogen. So, you know, you can stop everybody in seconds, okay. Now she can blender, she can lyse them in the presence of all these phosphatase inhibitors and run a column within minutes. But the key is you can actually stop everything in less than a second using the miracle of liquid nitrogen. Then you can restart it and do it fast in the cold and in the presence of protein inhibitors. So we think this is probably going to be okay. No. You know, of course. Right. Well, now, so the first, yeah, absolutely, and you do have an idea of what you're looking for, but this brings up the, okay, so to go back, the groundwork for the dynamical experiment that I just described, yeast has several hundred protein kinases and scores of protein phosphatases. So you want to take out every one at a time, and see who isn't getting phosphorylated. Now, this overlaps work, I might as well describe this, by a gifted chemist who was at Princeton, who's now at UCSF, named Kevin Shokat. And Kevin, in brief, engineers protein kinases so that they, instead of phosphorylating their substrates, they put on different kinds of phosphate-like groups.
If we go from base zero, what Perry is asking is, how do you tell the different substrates apart? It's very easy, because each substrate is a protein, and you cut it into peptides. Each peptide has a signature of mass and charge ratio that you can identify at this peptide and no else. So you can act, you have the entire mixture analyzed in terms of every single substrate and how much it gets phosphorylated. So, you can see the point. The mass spectroscopy actually dissects this gamish
into
individual. This is a technique.
No.
Let's assume that it's an entire protein.
Yeah,
peptide, is that synonym for protein?
Doran was using it as for a piece of a protein. Neither. Right. Okay. Okay. So the way I was presenting this and the way I want to work with this is with intact proteins, mass spectrometers, to add a wrinkle to this that I didn't described, like to work with smaller molecular weight objects. At the moment, the cutoff for Fourier transform ion cyclotron resonance protein mass spectrometry is about 20,000 Daltons. So we could do the same experiment, but what we're doing is freezing the guys in liquid nitrogen and then quickly cutting them to individual smaller pieces in the presence of overwhelming concentrations of proteolytic enzymes. So this will bust the things up into peptides. In each case, as Doran was saying, and particularly in yeast, you know the genome, you know the predicted mass of every species, you know the mass of every peptide, and in fact, mass spectrometers are getting quite good at going from a mass peak to individual identification. Okay, so that's, and so the vision here is that we learn how to do this on the complicated high expensive, only found in national laboratory machines, and we learn to identify individual mass peaks as corresponding to individual protein species, and once we're confident of that, we bring that in, and Reznikov is looking at now she knows that 11,235.7 Daltons corresponds to phosphorylated FUS3. So now she doesn't need the fancy guys in order to have comfort that that's the concentration of that she's looking.
There's a chance of obtaining experimental points on all the curves you have shown us.
That's the vision, yes. Yes.
And the key thing that's underlying this is that knowing the total concentration of the green protein is not actually so useful. It's the fraction that's bound in different ways.
Both are important.
It's not how many of the different components is which ways they're bound.
All are important. Okay, and if we're going to analyze the problem at this level, then we'll need to know all of those before. Okay.
And is it a case that quite often you can have two sides, four sides, phosphorylated,
and
make a difference in
the
aspect of the whole of
the. Do you have a sense on time scale? Should we be preparing for this kind of data in the next 5 years?
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. With 5 years, yes. I mean, yeah.
One curve would take 5 years.
Well.
One family of curves, or just one of
them? I guess the hope is that the number of individual protein actors in this is there's a number, but it's finite. The number when you go into the different possible actors is much larger, but it's still finite. I mean, we're not talking trillions of different entities; we're talking myriads. Mm-hmm. Okay. And look at UC Santa Barbara just making that Apple Talk available and not so. I'm just going to cover one. What I'm proposing to do is 5 or 10 more minutes and then cut this. I'm just going to cover one set of computational challenges. So what I haven't done today is give a general overview that I intended to do of other kinds of methods. But I think you're getting the idea that each one of these methods, if it's trying to explore something, it just runs into issues. Boom. I don't know if these are issues of the sort that are worth the time of a theoretical physicist, but they're issues. Okay, computational, generally speaking, the first important point is that the experimental problems are probably more difficult than the problems of simulationists are encountering. While we biologists are in there, kind of pretending to run gels and dropping things on the floor and stuff. These guys on the computers are meeting challenges and solving them with a kind of cheerful thing. So to give an example, this is a success story. So here's our scaffold again, now viewed completely differently, that protein called sterol 5. And it has on it sterol 11, sterol 7, and FUS 3. And sterol 11 can exist in 3 different phosphorylation states, sterol 7 in 2 different, etc. So in fact, sterol 5 is a dimer. We're pretty sure. So in fact, a simple calculation suggests that there's more than 25,000 different species involving sterol 5 and different phosphorylated molecules that are possible. Now isn't that funny, because there's only 5,000 molecules of sterol 5 in the yeast. So Well, it could be. Good God. You know, that the difference in individual cell behavior is not due to this cell has 3 molecules of this and this 11, but rather that this has a completely different complement of active molecules than this. Something biology had never... This is something that has come up from our simulation work. Other people may have run into it, but this is something that biologists don't talk this way. They don't want to think that that might be true. Well, let's say if there's 25,000 different permutations of species in containing sterol 5, one yeast might differ from one another, not because it has 3 molecules of it and the other one has 8, but because this yeast has 5,000 molecules, each of which, none of which have found in this other yeast. That's the nightmare possibility.
There are 25,000 over 5,000 different ways to make the yeast, just with respect to this yeast, right? You have to choose 5,000 variants out of 25,000.
Right. Now, hopefully, not all of these mean any. You know, not all of these are significant. Yeah, please.
If concentrations are large, that's not normally going to happen, right? That you're going to have some population being zero, and hence having some existing other
over. Oh, gosh, we just don't know. I mean, like, so these guys we think are always hopping on and off, and the phosphorylation is always happening. You know, so we don't know the distribution. We don't know what the kind of average distribution of species is, even in this well-understood thing. Right. Okay. So this is, needless to say, this is a likely to be a substantial experimental problem going forward.
You were suggesting that they are doing some computational advancements.
So meanwhile, just to code all the species, how do we do it? Okay, so what Larry Locke did was he just, you know, based on equilibrium, known equilibrium constants and so on, he just actually doesn't explicitly code individual species and the reactions that they would undergo. Rather, he lets species form. When they form, he immediately tracks them in code until they cease to be. And then they disappear from code. And then he has a little hash algorithm thing that he uses to tell when one species is the same as another species. And it all is rather slick and runs rather fast. So this problem was first encountered by a graduate student of Dennis Bray, who is a biologist who works on chemotaxis. Graduate student was named Morton Firth and was called the combinatorial explosion by Morton Firth in his PhD thesis. So. We have a way to work around this in code. This still leaves the significant experimental problem. So I think I might just stop there. You know, I mean, or it's switched informal or something. I mean, I could. There's nothing that's well formulated that this like grist for theoretical, immediate grist for theoretical work here. I guess if I had an ideological thing at the end, this came up after lunch as well. Look, I, as a biologist, I took tremendous risks in order to be able to be at this interface. I was able to do that because I was well known and credentialed, and because I thought it was the right science to do, and I've been able to get money, and I've been lucky in the sense that the precarious underfunded startup research institute looks like we can probably swing it on federal money. None of these things would obtain for a hypothetical 25-year-old who wanted to go down the same path. So, all of us need to... Well, so I got two things I want to say here. First, I've taken tremendous risks to step outside the established system in order to be able to do this. I would expect not all, but some physicists to take equal risks. And I know physicists who are more risk-averse. I would hope that there are people, perhaps in this room, who would be willing to like lay it all out on the line if this is something that's a kind of science they want to go there. And some of you are tenured and able to take those risks in, you know, not so such a serious way. I'd encourage everybody to set an example. So that's one. The other ideological thing is, all of us, I think we have to make mechanisms for these hypothetical 25-year-olds. We need to make it possible for them to do this and work on this interface. And in that process, we have to be vigilant. All of us know biophysicists are neither good biologists nor good good physicists, or certainly such people were frequent in the 1960s. We know bioinformaticians who are neither good biologists nor computer scientists. The only way we can, and not meaning to diss anybody here or anybody outside here, it's just a fact that on the boundary between disciplines, people can slip through. We need to keep each other honest. And if we do that, and we can figure out a way to encourage the 25-year-old, I think that's the kind of ideological thing I wanted to leave with. Then I think we can, not in this generation, but in the next generation, we can have people who unite some of these knowledge sets going forward. In this generation, the best we're going to be able to do is dialogues and multidisciplinary research groups. But so I'm going to be here for 2 or 3 days, and would, you know, I very much believe in building these bridges, and let's do it. So.